Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. And my guest today is the Reverend Maggie Whitehouse, who is an ordained minister, author and lecturer who teaches Kabbalah and the spiritual laws of prosperity, helping people to bridge the gap between the New Age beliefs and what she calls the sometimes ingrained religious beliefs of our upbringing. She is also the author of 15 books, and her latest one is called The Miracle Man, which we're going to talk to her about. So welcome to the program, Maggie.
Thank you, Mike. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm glad we could make contact with you. You're well travelled, and 15 books is pretty good going, to say the least. And I see you've been working in different times in local radio, national television, and world service. So you've got a very interesting background. I think
Several incarnations in this lifetime, that's for sure, Mike. Yes, I have.
Oh, well,
You being a radio host, because I loved my time in radio.
All right. So you've obviously filled your life up quite well up to now.
Yep, and I take Fridays off. People say to me, what's the secret of your prosperity? And if I want to be particularly annoying, I say, the secret of prosperity is quite simple. I take Fridays off.
Well, I think everybody should have time off for themselves to sort of get reorganized again. Now, I would like to do is to just talk a little bit about you before we get round to talking about your book and other aspects of your work. But what was it that you experienced which included an encounter with an 8-foot barracuda? And you also mentioned that you were saved from being killed by a train on a bridge over a river. Tell us about those experiences.
I think God had better things in mind for me. I think I'd been resisting my good for a very long time. I used to be a journalist. I was never a hard-nosed journalist, but I was quite a good journalist way back in the day when the BBC meant a bit more than it did, perhaps. I know what the first time on the China trip was when actually I was reporting for a TV documentary on steam engines in China, which was not a very girlish thing to do, but I love steam engines. In fact, my father was always a steam engine enthusiast, and I probably got my talent for writing from him because he wrote books about steam engines. I was in China one day and in the far northeast, and in those days, this was back in the early 1980s, it was quite a strange and frightening place for a white woman, and certainly they found me quite frightening. And one day I wandered out onto a bridge over a river, and I was being very brave because it was literally just a couple of railings and the track, and you could actually see the river underneath about 30 feet below you between each of the sleepers. And without realizing, I walked out on the bridge when there was a train coming.
Oh.
And fortunately for me, there was one tiny observation platform that was about 2 feet by 2 feet, and the security guard who was supposed to be looking after me saw the train coming and ran across the bridge. Remember, there were the slats and space between them. Ran onto the bridge, picked me up while running, and threw me and himself onto this little observation platform about 3 seconds before the train went past. That was terrifying, but it did make me realize that there was such a thing as grace, because that shouldn't have happened. He shouldn't have been able to run that past. He shouldn't have been able to have got me out of the way. And I've got a photograph of that bridge in my photograph album, and I show it to people, and I say, where's the observation platform? Can you see it? And never, ever can anybody see it.
Well, that's
so
incredible.
That's one. The barracuda is an even longer story. Are you happy for me to go ahead with that one?
Well, yeah, just carry on. We'd like to know what you've experienced, yes.
Fair enough. Thank you. Well, it's wonderful. Well, it was while I was in China, not on that trip, but the next trip, that I met my first husband. And I was such a... Oh, you know, we all wear these masks that we sort of hide ourselves behind. And I didn't marry until I was 32 because I was... I think very independent, but certainly very scared of settling down. And I was traveling in China, and the sound recordist on that second documentary I was making, asked me to marry him while I was out in China. And I had my defenses very low because I had to be very, very conscious, and managing a film crew is quite a scary thing. And to my complete astonishment, I found myself accepting his hand in marriage, which was amazing. We got married, and a year and 16 days after our wedding, he died. So that was what you might call the great wake-up call in my life. And two things happened at that point. The first was that at Henry's deathbed, a Catholic priest came and talked to me, as they do in hospitals, and asked me what my faith was. So I told him, and then what my husband's faith was. And I said, well, Father, he's an atheist. And he looked, he did that sharp intake of breath, you know, that hairdressers and taxi drivers do. And he actually did say, well, I'm sorry, my dear, but if he doesn't believe in our Lord Jesus Christ, he can't go to heaven. And now I can go, wow, because that was what changed my life. Hopefully we can come back to that later, because I just thought that's not right. Just because I signed on the dotted line doesn't mean to say I should get to heaven, whereas he, who is a better man than me, doesn't. But after Henry's death, I ran away to Australia. I had some friends out there who were doing a sabbatical, and this was in the days before the internet. And so it wasn't that easy to fix up with somebody who was travelling across Australia. We didn't even have mobile phones then. And I got to Cairns a couple of days before they were due to arrive. And it was my birthday. It was my 33rd birthday. And I was miserable. I mean, you can imagine, you've just been bereaved. I'd only been married a year. And I'd also lost my career in that time because I was an expert on China and Tiananmen Square had happened, so no journalists were going to China. So it was a really low spot in my life. And it wasn't that I wanted to kill myself. It was more that I thought I didn't mind dying. I mean, if a bus had run me over, I wouldn't have necessarily jumped out of the way. At least that's what I thought. So it's my birthday and I'm lonely and miserable in Cairns. So I do the most logical thing you can do, which is take a ship out to the Barrier Reef to do some snorkeling. But I'm a great believer in the law of attraction, which is like attracting like. And everybody out on the ship and everybody out swimming was really, really happy. And I wasn't. So I found them really, really repulsive. And so I swam around the other side of the ship. And in the deep water, I was just pottering along on the top of the water quite near the ship. And then I saw this extremely large fish in the distance, which saw me and started coming towards me very, very swiftly. And it had the porthole markings on the side and very big teeth. Now, I didn't know what it was at the time, but it wasn't a conventional shark, but it got its mouth open. It was coming very fast. And I remember lying there in the water thinking, I want to live. And the moment I thought that, a voice cut in quite clearly into my mind that said, swim fast forward as fast as you can, making as much noise as you possibly can, shout your head off, and if you get close enough, hit it on the nose with your fist. And it was just so contrary to anything else. There was nothing else I could do anyway, so I obeyed it. So I swam forward, yelling my head off in my snorkel, making some very strange noises, and got to probably within about 7 feet of the fish, and it flipped away, quite looking at me in a strange way, because I was trying to attack it. And the back of my head said, with a kind of resigned tone that I remember, because I was thinking, what do I do now? What do I do now? And it said, you can swim backwards. So I did. I swam backwards, and I hit the ship, and I went round the side of the ship and got out and was very, very sick. So that's that sort of story. But it was such a sign for me that there was something really looking after me, and that had happened twice, and that couldn't be a coincidence.
Absolutely, and by no means is your experience clearly unique. Other people have similar experiences, and indeed I've had two of a similar nature myself. So I never saw any other being around me, and I didn't get voices in my head. But I'm quite convinced on one occasion when I could have had a very serious accident and had severe injuries, that I was helped by what I call my angel presence, because I had fallen, and logically I should have really hurt myself. And I just suddenly, I had no awareness of the actual fall, and I suddenly found myself lying on the floor, and there wasn't a thing wrong with me. I had no knocks, no bruises, no shock. In other words, I had just been gently let down, and I was saved from quite a serious accident. So
you're absolutely right. It happens an awful lot, isn't it? If only we would regard it as normal rather than unusual, then perhaps we would feel a lot more trust. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because I'm a writer, so I'm kind of auditory. That's where my senses are. So I would hear things. And other people are clairvoyant. They see things. And you may be kinesthetic. You feel things.
Yes.
And the message gets through to you according to what your primary sensory aspect is, I think.
Yes, indeed. But it does show, doesn't it, and I know you must believe this, that we all have a purpose in life, and if it isn't your time to go, you won't.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And in my case, I am very grateful for that priest who said to me that Henry couldn't go to heaven, because it made me really wake up. I mean, up until then, I'd been what you might call an armchair Christian, which meant I went to church at Christmas and maybe Easter and the odd wedding. But I always summed myself up as, I think St. Augustine described it best. He said, God grant me chastity, constancy, and patience, but not yet. And this guy really woke me up. So when it came to Henry's funeral, in those days I didn't know you could have alternate funerals. I now do interfaith funerals for people because of what I learned from that, the fact that it's really important for a family to have a funeral of the exact level of faith that they have, whatever that may be. But I asked the vicar if he could not say, I am the resurrection and the life, and I am the way, the truth, the life, nobody comes to the Father except through me, because I told him that if he said that in the funeral, I'd be hearing my husband damned to hell. And at the time, he said to me, I'm sorry, my dear, but that's the way the funeral service is. So I did walk up the aisle behind Henry's coffin, hearing him damned to hell. And at that point, I threw conventional Christianity completely out of the window. But the trouble was, God wouldn't go. And so the next years were investigating the New Age, spirituality, spiritual healing. I joined what's now the Healing Trust, the National Federation of Spiritual Healers. I trained in Reiki healing. I studied alternate methods of healing. But even with all those, with Buddhist learning and meditations and Hindu work and everything else, it just kept coming back and back again and again. If you don't heal the sword that went in you, you're not healed. So I think the biggest driving force of my life, now that I'm over it, thank God, is to help other people get through all the limitations that we've learned, that our egos have taken on about, say, Christianity, or maybe it's Judaism, or maybe it's Islam, and helping them to find their own relationship with the divine, with the Holy One, whatever they want to call it. So just to slough off all these feelings around lack of worth, the need to belong to a certain religion, all these tribal beliefs that seem to be so important for us, but actually don't help us in any way, shape or form. So that's my job now as a priest and as a prosperity mentor, to help people to dissolve whatever it is that's stopping them being happy, and whatever religious or spiritual aspect it is about unworthiness or you should not, that are in their way. And a lot of these things are pretty much under people's radar for a long time. But when we point them out and show them how to do the healing on them, it's quite revolutionary what happens to people, because they just suddenly feel free. And you watch them become prosperous, whereas before they've been struggling. And I'm really blessed I do this work. It's extraordinary.
Yes. I think history shows that people have been led. And in the days, I guess, when people didn't have things such as schooling, perhaps many couldn't read, they did look to other people to explain, say, in our case, Christianity. Whereas I think in more recent times, we found that we've got a lot of knowledge within, and we can also seek our own knowledge. So it's breaking, I think, a mindset or rigid beliefs that we've had probably drummed into us right from the time we were children.
Yes, I agree. But I think even in the ancient days, even though a lot of stuff was drummed into us, we also still had that close connection with the planet. I mean, I think it's something like 98% of us are supposed to be living in cities by 2050, and certainly more than 70% of us live in cities now. We don't know the phases of the moon. We don't understand the land. We don't understand the cycles of life. We're closed off from death, for example. So I think in the last 100 years or so, although yes, there was the start of the breakthrough in the 20th century of people waking up, sorry, at the late end of the late 19th century with the Theosophical Society and things like that, there's been a kind of a closing in of minds generally with civilization, in that science has become the god now. Mm. And those of us who step away from science, did you do the census, Mike, this year, just now? And did you put holistic for your religion, like William Blue Masters too?
Sorry, I didn't quite catch all you said there,
Sorry, there's a guy called William Bloom who's one of the founders of Alternatives in London, and he launched a campaign. He was on the television on Sunday for everybody of a spiritual bent to write holistic for their religion in the UK census, which was last week, so that we could get a community together so that government would understand that the holistic movement was a really powerful one. So I thought that was a great idea of his.
It certainly was. I wasn't aware of that, and I wanted to put something in, so I've put myself in as a spiritualist, because I thought that expressed possibly as near as it could that I was a spiritual person with those type of beliefs.
That's fair enough. I think spiritualists are usually taken to be the spiritualist church, but it's a great thing to put if you aren't actually, you know, what they call the conventional religions. I think spiritualists are already recognised by the government, which is terrific. So maybe holistic people will be as well. I mean, I didn't want to put weirdo. It would just be a bit too much. And I'm not a Jedi Knight, so...
No, if I had known that, I would have put holistic in, because that is a good idea to create, if you like, another group of people that are recognised for what they are,
Well, we move on inch by inch, but we are very lucky we live now. We are so lucky. We're able to have a conversation like this with nobody even considering nailing us to a tree. And a couple of hundred years ago, that just simply wouldn't have happened.
No, that's true. And it's very good that things are more open, but nevertheless, I think people, like more often with politics, seem to be very reluctant to discuss their religious beliefs.
Yes, I can understand that, because religions come to mean fundamentalism, and there are, the thing is, all religion is now, I think, based on tribe, which obviously is quite understandable. In are you in my tribe, or do you have the same beliefs as me? If so, you are safe. And we have good points and we have bad points about the modern world, but my husband and I are actually organizing an interfaith conference in Birmingham on the 15th, 16th and 17th of April. So it's a mystics and interfaith conference, because we're taking the line that most of the interfaith work that's been around perhaps in the last 10 years since 9/11, is that it's taking place still from the tribal level. I go to these events and have people talking, and I'm learning a lot about Islam, and I realise very much that Islam is a religion of love, and that it actually means surrender to God. But when you go to these talks, the Christians, the Jews and the Islamic people still have this tendency of this attitude of, I am right, and I am tolerating you. But if you go to the mystical view, you actually have to rise above the ego consciousness of I am right, to there is one source, one being, with many, many aspects, and none of us are necessarily right except for ourselves. So we'll see what happens with this conference. We've got a nice attendance already, and hopefully more people are going to come as well. And the whole goal of the conference is for each and every talk and each and every exercise and meditation and movement is to raise us out of the ego state of what I know is right to the actual consciousness of us all being one. And I think it's the first ever interfaith and mysticism conference in the UK, and we've got speakers coming from California and Washington and Europe just for this one little conference, which I think shows a wonderful coming together of souls in an effort to sort of address the issue of it's not about tribe, it's about individual relationships with the Holy One and communication with each other at the level of the heart and the soul rather than at the level of the ego, which is the training, the repetition of the training that we must be safe within a tribe. I do whole swathes of work about ego and self in the prosperity money workshops that I do. And I think it's so important for people to realize that 90% of our thoughts, at least, come from the ego because they're just reactions. And on the news every night, they say, and let's go over to somebody for a reaction. You don't need a reaction. It's only going over the old ground again. What we need is response, which is a clear, okay, I don't know anything is right or wrong. All I know is what I can actually appreciate and see, and what can I do to find a solution. The self and the soul and the heart look at the issue and look for the solution, whereas the ego looks at the situation and looks for blame.
Mm. Yes, I quite agree with you with what you've said there. Now, you talk of New Age beliefs. Presumably, you would say that what you've just been speaking about is the same thing. But
yes.
How do you view New Age beliefs? What is the sort of key message, if you like, in a new way of thinking?
Oh, it's such a tricky one. I mean, at its highest level, it's coming out of the tribal consciousness to individuate. It's what Joseph Campbell, the great American mystic, calls the hero's journey, which is leaving home and going out on the journey to find yourself. And then when you find your true self, then you can bring that the knowledge that you gained back to the tribe if it wants it, but not if it doesn't. And you will then work for a higher good rather than the tribal good. It's a lifetime long task because there's so many aspects of our lives that we have to step out of the trained belief and then find what we truly do believe. And sometimes in the new age world, I've watched, certainly in the Reiki community and in a couple of other communities, what we do is we step out of the tribe of the family, then we join the tribe of Reiki Association or a different version, and we just go to another tribe and then make other people who practice our therapy in a different way wrong. And it's not really amusing, but it just shows that it's much more difficult than many of us think to sort of step up to the, what is the universal good here? Where can we seek the good? Where in Kabbalah, which is the ancient Jewish mysticism, it's not the one to do with the Kabbalah Center or Madonna or anything. This is a much, much, much older system that goes back to Bible times. We're taught that the nature of the soul is a kind of a meld between truth, beauty, discernment, and loving kindness. So whenever there's a situation, we're taught to say, is it true? Is it beautiful? Because you can have beauty without truth. There's a lot of glamour in the world today, which certainly isn't truthful. It may be beautiful and lovely to look at, but not truthful. And if it's true, there's always going to be a fierce kind of beauty to it. If it's ugly, it's not true. And you have to work that out by discernment, which is conscious thinking. Byron Katie's work I love, the idea of, is this true? Is this really true? Can I be absolutely certain that this is true? Who would I be if this wasn't true? How would the world be if it weren't true? And then you have the loving kindness of how can I apply love in this situation? Is the love in this situation required that I walk away? Or is it that I offer loving arms? Or is it that I listen? Or is it that I speak? So it being conscious, being awake, is very tiring. Most of us don't manage it for more than a few minutes a day.
With those comments, are you heading towards the idea of unconditional love?
Absolutely, but unconditional love, most people of my experience in the New Age speak of unconditional love and then bitch. So it's a very high concept to get to. Most people that I'm aware of, I'm not saying everybody, not at all, and I must be sounding very arrogant in this, but a lot of people you mean will say things like, well, I'm coming from the heart, or I'm coming from love. And when they say that, they aren't, because unconditional love does not need to inform other people what it is. It doesn't have to have the status of saying that I am love, because that automatically implies that the other isn't. And at heart and soul, we're all love. We're just covering it up with an awful lot of crud and then painting it pink and hiding it in the corner. But the true concept of unconditional love is an extraordinary and wonderful and powerful and in many ways a very fierce thing. Unconditional love means that you don't wade in a fight in any way whatsoever. You look for the solution, but you don't contribute to the war. Mother Teresa said, I will march for peace, but I will never march against war. And I got into a bit of trouble at the university chaplaincy in Birmingham a while back because they were doing an anti-Iraq war march, and I wouldn't join them. And they were saying, but you should, it's for peace. And I said, no, you've called it against war, I won't march. I will march for peace. Because if you go against something, you're fighting it and you make it stronger. And that's quite a difficult concept for a lot of us to get. It took me a while to get, but every time you rail against something or focus on the issue itself, you are actually drawing more of that negative energy, unless you're looking for the solution, unless you're sending healing or prayer or moving towards the aspect of love that's within it.
Yes.
Wow, you're asking me some great questions. Thank you.
Well, I can totally see your point there, and I think my response to that would be that if you're marching or protesting against war, that is it, full stop. You're not actually applying the energy, which is the way of solving the problem. So
absolutely,
when you're marching
yeah.
for peace, you're spreading peaceful energies, and you've mentioned the law of attraction, so that energy gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So I can see that is the way, yes.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned my novel, The Miracle Man, at the beginning. So if I may, I'm going to bring that in because it's a
Please
whole
do.
Book. I was very interested in a lot of people being very critical of things about The X Factor or American Idol in the holistic world in which I tread, hopefully lightly. But people used to have a lot of issues around the whole idea of talent shows. And I was having supper with a friend who was in marketing, and he said to me, well, who would Jesus be if he came today? And I said, goodness, I have no idea. And he said, would he be somebody powerful like Simon Cowell? And I went, no! And then I thought, oh, my God, what would happen if a judge on something like American Idol were a messianic figure, were a Gandhi-like figure, was somebody who absolutely expressed love and peace and joy? What would happen if they were on international television just spreading this message of love? And so I wrote this novel, which was such fun to write, about this guy who sort of mistakenly gets to be a judge on a talent show when his wife dies, who is, well, he's the most beautiful, perfect, loving presence. And because of him, the world starts to heal and the economy crashes immediately, because if people don't need drugs or alcohol or Medicare, then they're not going to be contributing to the economy the same way as they are when they're sick or they need a quick pickup. So when the world is being healed by this man on international television, the economy's going down, so actually the governments have to take him out.
Right.
So it's a cautionary tale. It has a happy ending, fortunately, and it also liberates Tibet in the middle of it as well, which I thought would be a nice touch. Oh, I had such fun writing it, Mike. It's selling peacefully, quietly, but very well. And I do get wonderful feedback about it, because what I did do with it was I took every miracle in the Gospels chronologically and updated them for the 21st century, so that every single story in the Gospels is in The Miracle Man for the modern day. And I had wonderful letters and emails from people saying, oh, my God, now I get it. Now I get it. Now I get what's actually going on in the heart of somebody who genuinely loves. So it was a fantastic adventure. I'm so lucky to be an author and have a publisher who'd let me put out a book as weird as that. But, oh, It's great. It's terrific.
Yes. Would you relate that in some way to our present situation on the Earth, where it seems quite clear that the level of consciousness, our mass consciousness, is rising up? And I would think in part this has accounted for all the activity in the Middle East. People are suddenly waking up, becoming aware that they can claim their own power, their freedom, their rights. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's similar to what you're mentioning in your book, where if this being came along with this message of love, etc., the old paradigm would no longer be suitable and crash. Would you see that as a similarity?
Absolutely. I mean, we are and have been for quite some time in what's known as the Age of Aquarius. And we had the Age of Taurus, and then the Age of Aries, and then the Age of Pisces, and now the Age of Aquarius. And Aquarius is its own priest. It's the individuation of humanity and seeing itself as its own priest. And certainly when we saw, I think it was Egypt and then Tunisia and then parts of the Arabic world and then Libya, people were suddenly standing up. There was a huge astrological conjunction. Astrology, I see, is a kind of blueprint, a kind of this matrix in which the universe works, and we humans sort of fall in and out of it according to whether we're using our free will, our consciousness or not. But when all this happened, this revolution happened, there were five planets in Aquarius, which is a sign of revolution in the Age of Aquarius. So that was a real tipping point for people. And then there was a conjunction of five planets in Aries, which is very warlike, which could have meant a powerful leader arriving, but unfortunately, so far, as far as we're aware, hasn't. And then there was a huge conjunction of planets in Pisces, which is not very good on boundaries, so it's all sort of going on and on and on a bit. And at the moment, we've got a Jupiter-Saturn opposition, which means expansion being fought by contraction. So there's some kind of cosmic plan definitely in place, but it's completely up to us, as it always is as humans. Can we step out of the tribe? Can we, in revolution, seek good instead of joining just another tribe? I don't know. All we can do is look for peace, pray for peace, support people where we can, and be as wise as we possibly can. But humanity is growing. I love Kabbalah's situation. It says that humanity is still very, very young. We're approximately 2 years old. And so we're going through the terrible tantrums of the twos. And we're going to be breaking a few toys in the process. But a loving parent, a loving consciousness, is going to understand that we're young. We are going through these surges of growth, which can seem very painful at times. But I do believe it's all for the good. And there's a long way to go. And this may seem a daft thing to say. I think even if we ruin this planet, which I don't think we will, but even if we did destroy this planet, there are billions of other planets, and a loving parent expects a child to break a toy. We're very young. It doesn't mean to say we shouldn't be good stewards of the Earth. I absolutely think that we do. But I'm not one of those ones that, oh, we're destroying the Earth, we're evil, we're wicked, we're this, that, and the other. We're kids. We're doing the best we can with the knowledge we've got. And it is changing because you can see the fractures in it.
Yeah. I guess the only problem is that as adults, although we may be babies in another sense, we do have responsibility for what we do. And
we do.
You do get karmic situations. If we aren't here to experience and learn from it, then the whole thing is a failure.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but we will always learn from it eventually. It just may take a good few lifetimes for it to happen. I'm pretty sure, and I quite often if I do individual prosperity counseling or spiritual direction with people, I get a lot of women who are uncomfortable being girls. They always wear trousers and they're quite well built and powerful, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that whatsoever. But I will quite often say to them, do you think that you're a male soul or a female soul? I don't actually know if souls have sexes, but I'm quite sure that we tend to choose one sex in repeated incarnations, so we get more used to being one or the other. And so many of them go, oh, now I understand. But they've come down as a woman, but they're more used to being a man. And we've got a lot of men very much more in touch with their feminine side now, who may have been women in a previous life. They're not so happy about that for some reason. They still don't think that's quite such a good idea. But I love this idea that there's a crossing over of masculine and feminine to learn the best of each. But that's also going to take a little bit of time. I mean, gay sexuality has only been accepted, and was only legal in the United Kingdom for, what is it, it's about 50 years now. That's nothing in the lifetime of a nation. So this is an extraordinary time when, you know, we can now have gay civil partnerships. Gay people are accepted, gay people are admired. It's fantastic. But that, what a revolution is that?
Yes, indeed. Fantastic. It is said that somewhere in the future we will become androgynous beings. And in that sense, we will be something, I suppose, that we're building towards, which is a balanced male and feminine aspect.
Quite possibly. I'm pretty sure we're androgynous when we're dead. I don't know. All these theories about the future, they're fascinating, but I'm a very... very solid, reliable, pedantic, plodding terrain. And I tend to say, listen, I don't understand the present yet. Can I get on with that now, please?
Right. Right, now, let's talk about a subject that must be dear to your heart. How about money and spirituality?
Oh, I do find it fascinating. When I was a journalist, as long as I was unhappy, which I was, I earned good money. When I became interested in holistic health and alternative medicine, I got broke. And it wasn't that I was bad at what I was doing, and it wasn't just that there weren't that many people interested in it. There was an issue around money, and I looked around my compatriots and found that they also had issues with money. And I started piecing stuff together. I did a lot of study with a church called Unity, which is based in Kansas City, founded by Charles and Myrtle Fillmore, and they did a lot of work around prosperity. Charles wrote a book called Prosperity, and they had a great teacher called Catherine Ponder, who was about the size of a lavatory brush with hair, a really fierce Southern woman who did these incredible books called The Dynamic Laws of Prosperity and Open Your Mind to Prosperity. And they taught that prosperity was our birthright, and that meant having whatever we needed and being able to manifest stuff the way Jesus could manifest stuff at the drop of the hat. And it really resonated, but it took me a long time to learn it because there's such a block in Christianity about spiritual people being wealthy. We were taught that Jesus was poor. There's actually no biblical evidence to that effect if you look at the Greek versions of the Bible and actual translations. In fact, a carpenter in Nazareth, it was 4 miles away from Sepphoris, which was Herod's capital, and had a huge rebuilding project going on because there was a fire in 4 BC. So an artisan would quite happily walk 4 days, four miles for work. And there was a huge amount of work. So Jesus' dad, and probably Jesus, from the point of view of being tradesmen, was seriously middle class. And that kind of thing we don't get taught. But we have all this stuff about the love of money is the root of all evil. That's the most commonly used one. And it's not what the Bible says. St. Paul has this wonderful phrase. I don't hold too big a brief for St. Paul. In fact, I really irritate a lot of people in the Christian church by saying, so you listen to St. Paul, who was a channeler, but you won't listen to Abraham Hicks, who's a channeler.
Mm.
One's 2,000 years ago, and that's okay, but one's in the modern world with relevance for the modern world, but that's not okay, because what St. Paul was doing was channeling Jesus. That's what he said. Anyway, the love of money is the root of all evil. The phrase actually is avarice, or how do we define it, but obsession with money. Obsession with money is the root of all the, and the Greek word is kakos, from which we get the word cack. And you know what cack means, don't you?
No.
well, let me say excrement.
Oh, I see.
But
okay.
A more slang word for it.
Right, okay.
Rhymes with something like clap or
yes. Yes, I'm with
so
you.
So what
now.
I'm saying is, if you're obsessed with money, it's the root of all the rubbish in your life. And having been really broke, having so many adventures in my life, I once ended up coming back from America where I'd tried to emigrate with my ex-husband, and I ended up peeling potatoes in a pub just to make the rent, having been a director and producer and presenter of live TV. And I was so broke that in the morning I would have to check what my bank statements were and perhaps move £5 from one bank to another bank in order to not go over my overdraft limit. And I was having to do that every single day. Now, that's the obsession over money that St. Paul was referring to. And also obsession over it if you've got millions and you're holding on to it. But anything that ties you to money with too much emotion can be the root of the excrement in your life. And that makes an awfully big difference from the word evil. The word evil in New Testament Greek is poneros, and that's used plenty of other times in the New Testament, but the word in St. Paul is kakos, which doesn't mean evil at all. And I was so fascinated by that, I learnt some New Testament Greek, and during the process of which I found out there are 32,000 versions of the New Testament in Greek, though fortunately for me, only 5,000 of them are seriously different. But in the most acknowledged ones, I looked through it and I retranslated, and I thought, this teaching about money is really beautiful, and it's really sensible, and yet we've learned all this stuff about spiritual people not being rich, that Judas was the bad guy and he had the purse, and that Jesus was poor and despised and rejected, and there's actually no evidence for it whatsoever. There's even a parable that Jesus tells that's never read out in church, in which he turns to the disciples and says, if you cannot be trusted in a relationship with mammon, that's false riches, the ungodly money, as in money that you might do bad things to get, I suppose. But if you can't be trusted with mammon, if you can't be trusted to deal with that, if you can't be trusted to work out how to manage that, how could you be trusted with the treasures of the kingdom of heaven? So Jesus is actually saying you've got to work out your relationship with money and what you're projecting on it, and the envy of other people or the hatred of other people who have money is part of this obsession which spiritual people have. And that brings us neatly back to somebody like Simon Cowell, with so many so-called spiritual people projecting so much anger at somebody who's wealthy because they don't think he's worthy. And it ties us up in such knots of anger. When I do the Spiritual Laws of Prosperity workshop, and I'm now doing teacher training, thank God, because I think this is the most important work we can get out in the world today, because we're now getting called on for so much charity. The calls on our charity are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and nowadays you can't throw enough money at the charities because it's not being received or understood or put to the best use, because the people receiving it don't know how to receive, and it's sort of falling by the wayside, like the parable of the sower. But there was a point to that, but I've kind of forgotten it in just the rant about the fact that if we don't know how to receive the divine radiance, the divine abundance, if we won't take time out every day in meditation to learn to receive, to learn to respect this flow of energy, then we're going to be poor. And there's a lovely quotation from Sarah Bann Brannock, who wrote a wonderful book called Simple Abundance, which she says, all poverty is first experienced in the soul, which means that we've actually got undercut in our soul's purpose, and we're following something that is about do, 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 as opposed to relax and receive. And I was talking to a client today whose coaching business isn't working for him. And basically what he did was he found something that he wanted to do, didn't check there was a market for it, and it wasn't working. So he just started doing it harder and harder and harder and working harder. And what we had to do was say, well, you've got to stop, because you're throwing energy down the drain on this, and you're spending no time on you. You're spending no time on receiving. You're spending no time in meditation. You're spending no time in understanding your own spiritual blocks to financial abundance. And this guy is bitterly angry at what he calls the fat cats and the bankers and the people who have a lot of money. But what we're trying to do is help him conceive of the fact that his very anger against those who are wealthy is a huge block to his own prosperity. So it's the absolute last bastion in spiritual work that people will address their prosperity issues. And you know the saying, give a man a fish, you feed him for life. You feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish, you feed him for life. But the thing is, you can't teach a man to fish unless you're a fisherman yourself. And you can't be a fisherman without patience and the willingness to sit and to notice and to know the way the river is going and what flies you have to have or what baits you have to have, and actually to really sit and understand this extraordinary flow which we humans invented, which we call money. And projecting our anger and hatred on it just stops the flow. The river doesn't come. Well, that was
right,
a man,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Right. Well, yes, I think, again, involved in what you've said is the law of attraction. I understand that there is not much point in saying I want. For the law of attraction to work, you say I have. In other words, you work on the basis I already have everything I want, and then you attract more. It sounds an odd way of doing it, but I understand.
No, I'm with you 100%. But people ask, but then they don't allow. They don't relax and trust, because we've not learned to trust. We still see... I've got a workshop coming up next month called You and God, a Relationship Workshop, because so many people have got so many projections on this celestial presence of authority and the vengeful God or the victim God or all these things. And so even though they're asking, they're not trusting that it's theirs. So they go on asking and asking and asking and never take a moment to allow it, to accept it, to believe it. And what we believe comes true. And if we don't believe it in the heart of hearts, we can say 1,000 affirmations, but they're not going to work.
Right. Now, I believe you when you said prosperity was our birthright, but how do we claim it back?
When you've got money, if you've got anything whatsoever, you spend it on celebration and spiritual growth before you pay the bills. That's the first and most important thing you do. It doesn't matter if you put 5 pence towards your spiritual growth or your celebration, anything that floats your boat, whatever rocks your socks, whatever makes you full of joy. If you put money towards that, you give a signal to the universe that you are a receiver and that you're worthy of good. But what most people do when they get any money is they pay the bills first. And to the law of attraction, that means my priority is paying bills, so it gives you more bills. It's relentlessly simple and logical. So that's the first great secret. And if anybody wants to know more about that, if they go to my prosperity website, there's a free one-hour webinar, completely free one-hour webinar that explains the whole principle of how to use money to start attracting prosperity. So please, if you're interested, go to pureprosperity.com, because it's 1 hour, totally free, no strings attached, and it will help you really get started on turning that tide around.
Oh, that's good. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
While you're there, I suppose you could give your other website address.
I've got so many. The interface conference is called La Convivencia, which is a Spanish word which means the coming together of souls. So that's LA-CONVIVENCIA.org. But the best thing to do is just Google me, Maggie Whitehouse, M-A-G-G-Y Whitehouse, because then you're going to find my YouTube videos, then you're going to find my blog, then you're going to find my Amazon author page.
All right.
And then you can go in whichever direction you want. The YouTube videos are full of free prosperity advice, and they've also got Kabbalah, Judaic mysticism, women in the Bible, sacred masculine and feminine, and everything like that. So just Google me, but make sure you spell the Maggie with a Y.
Right, that's great. Incidentally, just referring back to something you were talking about, and that is the question whether Jesus was really as poor as he's indicated. I did read a story which was channeled, which said, in fact, his family were quite well off. And it almost bordered on saying they were rich. So I think you're quite correct in your comments that you made.
Yeah, Oh, yeah. I think in my book, Credit Coins to Pure Prosperity, there's actually a whole gentle taking apart of the whole of the Nativity story with a sincere apologies for ruining your Christmas. There's no room in the inn. It's no room in the upper room. And in those days, if a woman was in labor, she wasn't allowed in the upper room with the other women because she would have made them impure with the passing of the water and the blood. So she would have to be segregated. And the stable was right next door to the kitchen, which is where the hot water was. And she could be with her husband, which she wouldn't have been allowed to be otherwise. And the no room at the inn, it's actually, the word is cataluma, which generally means upper room in a private house. It doesn't mean pub. That's a pantathon, which is what's referred to in the story of the Good Samaritan in exactly the same gospel. So again, interesting translations.
Yeah, I should tell you very quickly, because we haven't got too many minutes left now, a little tiny story. There was a person who went out of the body and was taken back to what you could call the nativity scene, and it was quite different to what you read in the Bible. And the one thing that struck this person when they came back, they said there was no donkey.
No, the donkey and the ass were invented by St. Francis. I think it's the 12th century. Yeah. He set up the first ever crib. And he was the one who bought an ox and an ass, and I think some sheep there as well. And ever since then, it caught on, and people think that it's in the Bible, and it simply isn't.
Yes.
So he was right.
We clearly have a lot to learn about that history. I'm just wondering what more we can say. Let me see. I'm just because we made a sort of late start, so to say, we're just working out how many minutes we've got left. Probably about 4 minutes, and I need the last couple of minutes to announce next week's guest.
Sure.
So is there anything you would like to say in the way of a message for our listeners?
That the natural right of humanity and the natural state of humanity is abundance, and everything else is resistance. And that may offend a few people or hurt a few people, but the truth is we are divine children of the Creator. We are creators ourselves, and our abundance and our joy always comes from creativity. So if you can seek creativity in your life, whether it's baking cakes or writing books or doing the garden, those are the things that will actually draw you to the energy of prosperity and start drawing you in. And there's lots of free resources out there on the internet, and it is entirely good for you to prosper, because if you prosper, you can teach other people how to do it. And if just 10 people who hear this go and download the webinar and learn a little bit about how to be prosperous themselves, and then teach it on to another 10 people who teach it on to another 10 people, then we're starting to get this good work out throughout the world. And there's no copyright on that work, on that webinar. If you like it, teach it on. Please, just teach it on.
Yeah, that's fine. Incidentally, I'm sure you must have read about it in other writings or channeling. It is said that there is, in fact, an abundance program in place, which will come to us in the very near future. So that rather ties in.
We won't receive it, though, Mike. That's the thing. We've got to be open to receiving it. It can
sail
right over our heads if we don't address our internal blocks to it. And no matter how wonderful the programs for us are, we've got to be open to receiving them.
I suppose people who didn't understand the issue like you do would be surprised that they couldn't benefit from abundance unless they responded to it in a certain way, because they might say, for example, but I'm very poor, I can hardly manage, they would think it would come to them as a right.
It doesn't, because we block it off. We block it off with our poverty consciousness and our beliefs. And most of these fly under the radar of the ego. We don't even know we're doing them. That's the tragedy. We keep asking for the prosperity but focusing on the negative. And it's always offered. It's always offered. What we have to do is unloose the chains that we've got that were trained into us as children.
Right.
The Jesuits had a saying, give me a child till he is seven and I will give you the man. And the training from our parents and from our religion and from our peers and from our teachers really locks into the psyche by the age of seven. So whatever we were taught stays there. There's a scientific survey at the moment that proves that clutter in your room, in your eyes, actually stops your mind functioning properly. And clutter in your thoughts about money and finances and anything that makes money wrong.
Right, Maggie, I'm going to have to stop you there, and thank you very much for coming onto the program, because we are right at the end, so thank you very, very much. Gives me about 10 seconds to mention that Ryan, my guest next week will be Asura. It's a return visit. She is a channel for the Divine Union, Yeshua and Magdalene, and she's the founder of the New Human Project and through Awareness Effect. So, thank you for being with me today. That was a terrifically interesting guest, and I do hope you can make it next week. God bless you all.